Les séminaires du Collège de France.
Très bien, nous pouvons recommencer. J'ai le plaisir de présenter Emiliano Zaccarella, spécialiste de neurosciences cognitives avec une référence particulière au langage. Emiliano a étudié à Sienne aussi, Master Language and Mind de Sienne. Ensuite, il a obtenu son PhD à l'Université de Leipzig et de Berlin avec la grande spécialiste d'imagerie cérébrale Angela Friderizzi. Et il travaille maintenant à l'Institut Planck de Leipzig. Emiliano a donné beaucoup de contributions importantes dans le domaine de la neuropsychologie et des sciences cognitives, neurosciences cognitives du langage. Je voudrais juste souligner un aspect. Il y a beaucoup d'excellents expérimentalistes, spécialistes de neurosciences cognitives, mais il y en a très peu qui connaissent aussi la linguistique très bien, comme dans le cas d'Emiliano. Et donc, comme vous le verrez dans sa présentation. Bienvenue à Paris et merci d'être ici avec nous.
Merci Luigi. Donc, bonjour à tous, je suis Emiliano Zaccarella. Donc, je vous remercie pour votre présence ici. C'est mon plaisir, je suis vraiment très honoré. Merci Luigi pour cette invitation. J'en suis vraiment très honoré d'être ici. Je suis honoré de t'avoir connu, de t'avoir ici. Comme convenu, la présentation se fera en anglais. Je suis désolé, mais mon français est un petit, comment on dit, rusty. Ça marche ça. Bon, on peut partir maintenant. Donc, d'accord. The title of the current presentation today is the combinatorial linguistic mind, and the goal today is to give you a few neurolinguistic perspectives of the work we've been developing in the past few years at the Max Planck Institute in Leipzig, in my group, starting from my PhD, and especially with the Department of Neuropsychology headed by Professor Friderizzi, and sponsored together with most of the work by the Deutsche Forschungsgemeinschaft, which is the centralized sponsoring center for research in Germany. Overall, again, the goal is that to offer you in a way that we could be as informal as possible some potential approach at the interface between linguistic theory, psycholinguistics, and especially neurolinguistics, with the goal to see how we could eventually test how competence can be represented in a human, and as we'll see later in the last part of the talk, in the human brain. So very briefly about me, thanks Luigi already for introducing me earlier. So I'm a group leader currently in the neuropsychology department of Max Planck Institute for Human Cognitive and Brain Science in Leipzig. And I've done my PhD in cognitive sciences at the MPI together with Uni Potsdam and the Berlin School of Mind and Brain, part of the excellence cluster at the Humboldt University. And as Luigi already mentioned before, I hold a MA in linguistics and a bachelor in communication science at the University of Siena together with the University of Edinburgh. Because of my background in linguistic theory, and it was shivering this morning too, I went back in time this morning when I entered the room and Luigi was giving the talk. So my very first lesson at the university in Siena was exactly linguistics, and 2 hours later was semiotics, so it was already quite clear divide what my future would have been. Very happy the first 2 hours, quite disappointed the last two. My approach to experimental linguistics starts with the observation of a few basic facts about human language. Let's consider a sentence here, the ship carries tropical flowers. Well, we immediately understand the sentence without any hesitation. We immediately grasp the content, the structure, the subject, the verb, some object. Now, the point that I want to make is very simple. No one has ever produced this sentence before, but you're immediately able to understand it. And we can prove that by going to internet and Google Grams very quickly. And the point is that when we look at the occurrence of bigrams like the sheep or the sheep carries until four grams, we see that all of them, like the sheep carries, carries tropical and tropical flowers, they all co-occur with a certain amount of frequency in the n-gram corpus of Google. But the sentence, the sheep carries tropical flower, never occurred to us. not unless we were immediately able to understand it without hesitation or pause. If we go further, we can play around now with meaning, and I can produce something like the ship dreams of liquid glass. This is arguably meaningless, but not unless we understand the structure of the sentence, so if we are poets, we could even try to get some meaning out of it. And again, if we do some very little empirical testing, we again can prove that although we're immediately able to understand the sentence, at the same time all the co-occurrences here were occurring in the n-grams, but the overall sentence altogether never ever occurred in any corpus of human language so far, at least until 2021 at the very back. At the same time, I think that our linguistic mind can immediately understand that the sentence here, what's called pseudo-sentence in neurolinguistics, does not make much sense. The plurk fringes the flanis pole. But at the same time, I think we have an intuition to see that there is a potential subject, there's a potential noun following a determiner, there is a verb with some morphological information, and that's probably an object with a determiner, an adjective, and a noun. Another point now is that if we play a little bit more around, we also have an idea that if we shuffle words around, now all of you can tell me, well, the sentence does not really make sense, but importantly also missing some syntax. So we are immediately able to tell, well, the sentence doesn't really make sense, also from a syntactic point of view. There is no ordering nor hierarchical organization. So to summarize very briefly, we could say that in our daily lives, we constantly share complex state of affairs during communication. We do that by combining words into an unlimited numbers of phrases and sentences of any length. And it's very beautiful to see the continuum between Luigi's lessons this morning and few of the observation and the starting point that I'm making here and potentially conclusion later on. So we are faced with this potentially unlimited number of phrases and sentences of any length, which, however, we might not have produced or heard before, as for example A and B, but which can easily tell if they're grammatical or not, irrespective of meaning. Now, one interesting point is that this is also true for different modalities. That's, for example, sign language, German. So the physician invites the professor to the left. That's the Deutsche Gebärdensprache, so German sign language. But we can also create pseudo signs, as for example, the one to the right, which to German language, German sign looks like pseudo language, although that's Brazilian sign language. But for a German speaker, they would say, well, there is some syntax. I can tell that there is a subject, there is a verb, and there is regardless now the order, the object. But nonetheless, also signers can easily tell if something makes sense, if something is syntactically structured, and if something is meaningless and syntacticless. Let's move a little bit further about some additional facts about simple facts about human language. If we now go very briefly to any corpus, for example, that's a classical case of childhood, so collection of spontaneous productions in children vocalizations, what we could see is that within the first 3-4 years of life, there is an increasingly steeping in the mean length of utterance in little children. That's the case of Caroline with German from the German corpus. So the speaking child is immediately able within 2 years of life to produce continuously longer sentences and phrases of grammatical quality. If you go to the right, what spurious fact you have seen is that this increasing pattern is there regardless of whether a child might be a hearing one or a deaf child. However, when we begin to look at non-human animals, as for example, classical chimp here from the classical Pierce book, we see that the combinatoriality of this animal here remains around one all over years. By sitting in the interface between linguistic theory and neurolinguistics, an influential hypothesis that has been put forward now since the emergence of the generative grammar program is that an influential hypothesis in linguistic theory is that human may possess some linguistic combinatorial competence, which must be based on abstract relationships, which are word categories. So we are able to understand the structure of a sentence, although the sentence doesn't make sense, like for example, pseudo-sentence, which may imply that we have an abstract tendency to look at categorical abstractions. that is independent of meaning, that is independent of modality of use, we have seen in sign language as well, which should be readily available during development, the second last fact that we have seen, and the last fact which might be unique to our species. Now, moving from these very simple observations, the overarching goal of cognitive neuroscience is that to understand how human beings process complex thoughts, constrain ourselves to language. The goal of neurolinguistics becomes that of understanding how the human brain may encode this linguistic combinatorial competence across languages in health and clinical populations, and how this is reflected in behavior through language development and evolution. Now, when you make a step from linguistic theory to neurolinguistic, you must be faced with what is called a mapping problem, which is a huge tension between the different disciplines that we'll see in a second, when we include a dimension which is only present in the second but not in the first. So neurolinguistics stems from the big neuroscience tree as a child of the big neurology path, so the study of the nervous system, and as a part of the cognitive neuroscience, so the study of how we react and process and understand a certain stimulus and our response to that. So neurolinguistics is the study of the neural system that has something to do with linguistics. This definition brings us to two aspects of the mapping problem now that are going to be stated. Mapping problem can be essentially defined as a bidimensional problem. On the one side, we talk about an ontological problem. On the left-hand side, we have distinct primitives between language, so units of linguistics like words, categories, nodes, and the abstract linguistic knowledge. And on the other side, we have the units of representation neuroscience, which are nerves or neurons and so forth and so on, and the concrete neural matter. So on one side, we have the units of linguistics like this, and units of neuroscience that are a completely different type. And then we have the very famous granularity mismatch problem, that the link between the two elements is not one-to-one. There is no need or obvious explanation why a word should correspond to just one cell, for example, or two words to two cells, or a node should correspond to cell assembly, and so forth and so on. So on the left-hand side, we have an ontological problem between what we have here and what we have here. On the other side, we have a granularity problem between the units we have here and the way how we could match them to the right-hand side. Now, I've been talking about a big missing when moving from linguistic theory, as we have seen the past 2 hours, and now we're trying to map this abstract linguistic knowledge to some concrete neural matter. Well, what could be the dimension that needs to be included when we face the need to see how this maps to here? Well, time. So when we approach neurolinguistics, you begin to think that you're not analyzing a sentence in a temporal manner. So we've seen earlier, like stickerment relationships or displacement, but you are processing a sentence and try to understand what happens in the brain while you're processing the sentence in real time. So neurolinguistics is asking what's happening in the brain in order for me to make this link between here and here, while my brain is reading a sentence like the ship carries tropical flower, or for example is hearing it, or for example is seeing it signed. So we might slightly reformulate the overarching goal of neurolinguistics by saying that by measuring performance factor and how performance constrains competence in real time. So we've been talking about the infinite possibility of recursive embeddings, which is however limited by working memory constraints on attention. By measuring performance, we like to understand how the human brain encodes linguistic combinatorial competence across a clinical population and how this is reflected through language development and evolution. So we want to test language in real time and try to see how our brain use this competence over performance to understand how language is processed in the human brain. In order to do that, we will go very briefly through some notions of competence. It will be very striking to me, beautiful to see how, on a very reduced way, I will be just repeating what Luigi has been doing for the past 2 hours. Then we'll move into what I call the functional space. So we will be looking at, through fMRI, we'll see in a second what fMRI is, what the anatomical regions involved in synthetic processing are in the human brain, just to establish what we call the functional space within which competence might be eventually reflected, and how the different regions might talk to each other to accomplish this task. Then the central part of the talk, we'll try to bring together timing and functional space and parsing models to bring together the how, the when, and the where of something is happening in the brain while processing language. In the last part of the talk, we'll be briefly mentioning the modality independence of the linguistic system compared to the motor system and its domain specificity. And last but not least, we'll be briefly going through development and evolution with respect to what we have seen here to propose a uniqueness hypothesis, which is just an empirical hypothesis over which I'm not able to take position right now, but just suggestions. So before starting that, let's begin to look at what abstract linguistic knowledge might be or we need to begin creating experiments upon. So if we go back to the sensor we've seen earlier, 60 years of work have told us that we might better represent this sentence as a set of categories to which the words belong, which can be merged together or assembled together to form constituents of increasing complexity embedded with one another. And the very simple idea is that humans have the capacity to abstract over words, to retrieve the categorical information of a certain word, which, according to some features, can be bind to another element to create more and more complex elements. And syntax would not work on words, but would rather works on categorical elements that we are labeled more and more on. So on this account, a very simple, reduced approach that would be needed from competence to be implemented in performance is that to try to answer very simple questions. Where do we know that the is a determiner and apple or ship is a word? How do we categorize them? And we would like to know how do we know that these two elements can be bound together to be, for example, labeled DP, to use an arbitrary terminology, but how we go from this level to this level. And last but not least, what happens when we reapply the same procedure? So as you can see, this is just a miniaturization of what the program of the past 23 years in syntactic theory has been proposing, that phrases and sentences are hierarchies of constituents that are merged binary to form more categorical, complex syntactic hierarchies, and a few categories of relationships generate, process infinite new sentences. And what Luigi has been showing before, the comparison between ChatGPT and the human judgment was nothing but another way to say that we have this tendency to what we call it in neurolinguistics or in evolutionary linguistics, dendrophilia, this necessity to impose syntactic trees on a linear array of words that we are faced with. Why do we talk about hierarchies? As also we just shown you before, very simply, we need one way to think about that from a more simplistic point of view is that we need anchor points across the structure to work on structures themselves. So I could perform substitution here by substituting liquid glass with a pronoun only if I have intermediate anchor points that will allow me to substitute a liquid glass with it, which would not be possible using a flat structure. Now, we have just given you here a very simple, again, reduced, minimalistic definition of what competence in human mind might be looking like. But what we need now is also to understand how to drive through the brain in order to see what A could be corresponding to B. So we need to give a very simple but very very clear information about some concrete neural matter we're working on. So, and that's quite spurious. That's a human brain. And human brain, as a gross anatomy, it's called just a telencephalon, so the outer brain. And we always talk about two different hemispheres, the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere. And if we now open them up a little bit, we see the corpus callosum, which is a huge amount of axons linking the two hemispheres. And that's the very first notion. So we have two hemispheres, and apparently one of them is more important than the other for language, regardless of your hand, you're writing. And when we look at the brain, we describe the brain as we would describe, using geographical terminology, mountains and flatlands in the world. So if you look at the brain, we use morphology to describe how the brain looks like in terms of folding and holdings, and the cerebral hemispheres are characterized by what we call gyri, or gyrus, or crests of folded tissues, and by sulci, or sulcus singular, which are the grooves and spaces that the gyri divided are by one another. Although those gyral and sulcal pattern vary among individuals across the cortex, some very important ones are found in any and every single brain, which are very important to divide the cerebral cortex in each hemisphere into four lobes. So we have two hemispheres, we have different gyri and sulci, which are like the mountains and the flatlands in our brain. But although these brains change across individuals, there are some sulci and some gyri that are very important as a reference point, which are very needed for us to give addresses to our brain. We have the lateral ciliary fissure here between the temporal and the frontal parietal cortex, the parietal occipital sulcus here, and the central sulcus. And why this is important? Because according to these landmarks, we can split the brain into four major lobes: the frontal lobe, the temporal lobe, the occipital lobe, and the parietal lobe. Frontal lobe, parietal lobe, occipital lobe, temporal lobe. If you now just cut the brain into 1,000 slices, we do something even more interesting. We can now see, now I'm just cutting the brain along a certain axis, and then we could see that the brain is characterized by what we call gray matter and white matter. The gray matter is where the neurons end or start. The white matter is made by the axons, so that the bodies of the cells that link into the different regions. And thanks to many works, like for example Kibian Brodmann in 1999, so a very influential guy who worked actually in Leipzig, for each individual gray matter area, we can look at how the layer of the gray matter density values are about. So here we could see that given the different type of cells and the ending or starting certain layers, we can define different areas according to their cell density profile. And that's what we call psychoarchitectonics, so the lamina. And we look at the concentration of particular nerve cell types in certain regions. And because of this density that changes according to the different regions, based on that information, we can create atlases, like for example, the Brodmann Atlas. And why is this important? This is important because given the nerve cell concentration, different regions can be divided, and each of these regions has a different number. And those numbers, 44, 45, 21, 22, these are the numbers that we need and that we use to know where we are in a certain part of the brain. So you will be hearing over and over certain numbers like BA44, Brodmann Area 44, Brodmann Area 45, which is actually Broca's area, or Brodmann area 22, which is actually Wernicke's area. So these numbers are based on satellite architectonics and are needed by the neurolinguist to communicate the data and to say, well, these two areas are involved in certain process A or in certain process B. So that's just a very simple priming for you to understand the place we are. Now, of course, we need, in order to map A to B, language to brain, we need also to give a very short info about the type of imaging methods that we use. And we can divide the experimental methodology along two different dimensions. We have a spatial resolution here from very low to very high, and a temporal resolution from very low to very high at the other axis. And although we will be mostly talking about fMRI today, and the fMRI has a very nice is a very nice method nowadays, non-invasive, which gives you a very high spatial resolution in terms of millimeters of neural activity, but has a very low spatial resolution, although now we're improving with the methodologies. But essentially, We take a picture of the brain every 2 seconds, so we are observing what's happening within 2 seconds of the brain, although we are reading a sentence for probably 500 milliseconds. So keep in mind, it's as if you're taking a picture on the motorway at night and you leave open your camera for 2 seconds. So you just see streams or line of cars going through the motorway. But nonetheless, this is the most influential method to look at localization in the human brain. To the right side, we have methods that have a very strong temporal resolution in terms of milliseconds, but have a very poor spatial resolution. For example, MEG and EEG, magnetoencephalography and electroencephalography. And then you can move further to have a source space MEG or EEG and electrocardiography, so where we can stick electrodes in epileptic patients before seizure to see how certain neurons are behaving at the moment. So that's optimal solution to meet both spatial resolution and temporal resolution. As I mentioned briefly before, we'll be mostly talking about fMRI with some discourses on MEG and EEG methodology. Okay, now let's now go into the main part of the first column to the left. So if you remember, so like the search for a functional space for language processing. So in a very standard way that in the past 20 years has been used to look at areas that are involved during syntactic processing in human language, instead of comparing correct sentences, with word lists with shuffled word orders. So the ratio behind that is to say, if I compare the hemodynamic response of the brain of the processing of this structure here compared to this one, we should see as a difference, those areas, they are responsible for the syntactic correctness of this sentence compared to the lack of syntactic processing here. And if we go across all studies that have been done using this type of approach, we are nowadays, these are just a part of it, like 20 studies, but of course there are now more and more coming in. And we use a so-called meta-analytical likelihood estimation. So for each individual experiment, I can look at how consistent the activation of that specific study is with respect to the process. What we find out is that when we generalize across these old studies comparing sentences or phrases versus word list, we quite interestingly see a clear pattern of regions in the left hemisphere which are involved in syntactic processing. So left inferior frontal, anterior posterior, so-called anterior and posterior superior temporal gyrus, are involved during sentential phrasal processing in the human brain. That's just a very simple observation. However, I guess that some of you might have already asked, well, the effect may reflect both syntactic but also semantic information processing. In the very end, you are reading a correct sentence, you're comparing it to a word list. So can we separate the effect of hierarchy from the effect of meaning? So can we separate the effect of syntactic processing from that of compositional semantics? And the enterprise, at least until that started already, like in the early 2000s, has been that of creating artificial grammars that might imitate relationships that are found for human language without involving meaning. And in the past 20 years, there have been an increased amount of studies on artificial grammar learning and processing that have tried to simulate structures that we see in human language and to somehow make them learn by participants in the scanner. So here to the left, you have a classical so-called double embedding structure, which to those of you who do not really speak German or master German might be a suicidal process, but something like, ich denke, dass Maria die Hans der gute Aussage liebte, Johann geküsst hatte. Probably even 60% of German people are not even able to process the sentence. So it's a perfectly classical example of embedding in human language. It simply says that I think that Maria, or Hans, who was good looking, loved, kissed Johann. So here you have the important point for you is that here you have three subjects that have a link to three verbs. And the idea is that of taking this kind of example and create phrase structural grammar, so-called PSG, that would be an AN, BN grammar, and ask subjects to learn these relationships. And then the idea was essentially that of comparing the processing of, for example, syllabic sequences, where they knew that LA, that for example, the A can only correspond to a sound like Q, that sound like SA can only correspond to a sound like BU. So participants would hear in a scanner something like LE, RI, SE, DE, KUBO, FO, GE, or KUBO, FO, GI. And they've learned that before, and they know that here they would expect a 2, but a GI comes in, and then you would see the type of activity that you would appear in the brain when comparing the incorrectness against the correct grammatical structure. So there was a first attempt to see, in the lack of meaning, how these relationships that would imitate human grammar might be processed in the human brain without considering semantics. And as you can see, the very important point was that we are talking about a very French Apienis paper from 2006, that the posterior IFG, BA44, seems to be the only region involved in detecting incorrect grammatical structures based on this type of artificial grammars that imitate embeddings in human language. So the conclusion that was made by the time was to say BA44 might be involved in syntactic processing. However, and many of you are syntacticians here, current artificial grammars, I do not think that they really reflect human language syntax. I mean, this is just an approximation of how human syntactic structure might look like, but that's rather a relationship between different elements that do not have any relationship between each other, and that's for me has always been the crucial difference between human syntax and this type of artificial grammars. So essentially, deku has nothing to do with SA, with SA, bo, o. But in human language, we have complementizers that would link the innermost element with the top one. And as you can see, the comparison between a phrase structure of the type and a language syntax is rather striking. So one first work that we have done in this respect is to try to answer this question to improve studying of artificial grammar by investigating the capacity to use abstract categories to create hierarchies using artificial grammars or hierarchical grammars that would reflect human syntax. So in this study, we had subjects learn these sequences, but they could only tell us that the sequence was correct only if we knew that they would belong to certain categories that could be joined together or merged together as human syntax. And to be more precise, children would know that something like A can only be merged with B, and that, for example, to form, or C to B to form BC, but this sentence could only be correct only if they already knew that an element BA could be compared with an element BC. And so we explicitly ask them to learn certain items that belong to certain artificial categories and to learn the rules that would imitate, for example, the terminator, nouns, and verbs, how they could be combined together, and compare them with those associative grammars that we have seen before, this phrase structure grammar, so that where the relationship is only based on some independent relationship between the two elements. And the interesting point here is that when we look at the processing of these structures that to us strongly imitate human syntax and the processing of combining elements to one another to create structures, we strikingly see again the involvement of BA44 together with posterior STG. So BA44, to conclude this study, is that BA44 and posterior STG appear to support the processing of syntactic hierarchies based on categorical information. So the subject here have no access to real words, they're only working on fake syllables. They know that these fake syllables belong to certain abstract categories, and in order to tell me that Bemu Koli is correct, they needed to perform this type of build-up reconstruction. Now, based on mathematical methodologies that we can apply nowadays, we could also further begin to infer how the information between the different regions in fMRI can be passed to another. This is methods that are called, for example, dynamic causal model or Granger causality or effective connectivity modeling. And what we see here, essentially, that it seems that when subjects are asked to process this type of structure, the driving input is in BA44. So BA44 is immediately involved, and then there is an interplay exchange between the different regions. So BA44, also based on previous studies on more complex syntactic processing, BA44 in Broca's area seems to support the establishment of correct syntactic hierarchies based on categorical information. And the posterior STG, based on a lot of evidence we have, which are not discussing here, may function as a general storage and integration system for hierarchies that are already generated. Now, this was, in a sense, just introductory, for a very simple reason that, and that's been also the study of my PhD work, is that I think that the important point of the interface between linguistic theory and neurolinguistics, and including binary branching, including the three different questions we want to have, lexicon, category, and node, I think that an important point to sit at the interface between linguistic theory and neurolinguistics is that of reducing the amount of stimulus complexity we like to test to investigate the combinatorial capacity that we use to abstract categories from the real lexicon at the most two-word level. So to see how linguistic combination might not be an all-with-all process in a way that we can understand how two words can be combined together and how different type of categories can accomplish this combination. So and the idea for me is that the two-word combination level is for me the kickstart of the syntactic machinery and is an ideal testing ground for at least three different aspects. So when we look at what happens in the brain, when we ask participants just to read or to listen to two-word combinations, we can begin to observe the properties of the basic combinatorial linguistic mechanism. We can begin to ask questions about the lexicon. How do we know that the and ship are two different categories? How do we manipulate categories to form nodes? And then at the same time, we begin to test the emergence of combinatorial processing in children, so the two-word horizon, and understand the evolution of combinatorial processing in the non-human primates. So this is now quite a standard work, and there have been many replications on that. In this study, we had real words, like for example, the terminal this, together with a pseudo word to reduce semantic information, be compared with a noun, with a list of two nouns that could not be compared, combined to one another. And when we ask subjects to read these structures, what we see is that there is a very clear difference in hemodynamic response activity between the forming of a determiner phrase like this flerk and a list like, for example, apophoric, meaning that this very specific area of BA44 seems to be highly and more significantly involved for this processing in forming a simple phrase like determiner noun compared to a word list of two syllabic elements. And on top of that, we move further by showing that within the BA44 area that we mentioned earlier in the posterior Broca's area, it seems that the activity that we measure for the comparison between phrases and lists seems to be very clearly localized in what sub-area of the cluster, so-called cluster 3-3 in BA44, showing that syntactic processing might be very well localizable in this specific subcluster in this area. And this is also very important and crucial when we'll see at the very end of the work, where we begin to ask whether BA44 in evolutionary perspective is also involved in motor processing. And we begin to see that there is a very clear divide between anterior regions involved for language and posterior regions involved for motor processing. And we do this by looking how the individual activity of our participants is really localized in this area. And then we see that all our subjects really made use of this specific subregion to understand that this flerk would be a determiner phrase compared to a noun list. Now, at the most basic two-word level, the combinatorial processing lacking semantic information or with reduced semantic information seems to involve very specifically neural populations of the most anterior ventral BA44. So a very short conclusion is that when we would like to bring two elements together to form a phrase, this specific area in BA44 seems to be highly involved. Now, we, in different studies, begin to play around between the interplay between lexical and categories, and now we go a little bit further in what we would call in linguistic theory some feature matching processing. And in this type of study, we begin to play around different two-word combinations, such that we had both the terminal phrases, or let's call them NPs formed by adjective and noun, or DPs formed by the terminal and noun. And the question now begins to be the following. We know that human language is not an all-with-all process. We do not put words together randomly, but they follow some specific rules based on the categories that are put together. And what we begin to do here is not to compare phrases to word lists, but to compare phrases to another, to try to get an understanding between the interplay of the mental lexicon we have in the category these elements belong to. So we would have the terminator noun on one side and adjective noun on the other side. Hypothesis zero is that merge or assembly or composition is always one and the same process and the same region might be involved. Hypothesis one is that depending on the word you're including in the combination, different subregions might be involved. And using what we call multivoxel pattern analysis, which is nowadays a very standardly used machine learning, artificial intelligence machinery, we ask which regions in BA4445 in inferior frontal gyrus contain the most informativity to recognize these words as belonging to adjective noun or the terminator noun. So in this case, we ask certain voxel to say, tell me if you recognize this word, this combination as adjective noun or a determinant noun. And what we see is that here we could see very clearly this double association, essentially that those voxels that are able to identify the determinant noun as a possible phrase are localized in BA44, while those voxels that are most useful to identify adjectival noun combinations are more localized in the anterior BA45. So these internal subdivisions in Broca's area are sensitive to the recognition of categorical relationships during combinatorial process based on different demands placed on syntactic or semantic processing. So we give for granted the fact that the determinant combination is rather based on a very reduced syntactic information compared to something like a blue book, which involves a lot of conceptual processing. And this example here is very striking because probably most of you know the recent works within the EEG-MEG area, like the Ding, Nelson studies, Pepe, that have been showing now that it seems that our brain is able to recreate internal waves that are not present in the stimulus that actually track the considered structure of the sentence. But the crucial point is that following studies begin to show now that this tracking of creating phrases and sentences is not a one-for-all process independently of the words that come in, but actually changes according to the elements that are into the forming the combination. So here you have the terminator noun, here you have a verb, a preposition, here you have, for example, a preposition or adjective. So, and also the people here, like but also look at Burroughs and Casey and Carral, they would conclude that our results, as we've shown before, support a model in which the brain uses word-level grammatical category to build larger units. So we might have some universal characteristic to build elements together, but the brain needs to know what type of elements we are actually building together. And the interesting point is that when we take the different type of phrases in input that we saw before, we see that this network modulations through Bayesian combinatorial processing recapitulate what we have seen before for complex syntactic processing with this famous driving input in BA44 and the integration that in this loop goes through the superior temporal cortex. Now, this loop is reminiscent of what we know now from the structural point of view, where the two areas, the inferior frontal gyrus and the posterior temporal cortex, are structurally linked by longer fiber tracts along the arcuate fascicles. So, network modulations through Bayesian combinatorial processing recapitulate complex syntactic processing we have seen in the first part of the presentation along most probably the arcuate fasciculus. It's always funny that AF is also Angela Federici, so but that's just among our group of people. Now, however, what we could also do in the brain is also to look at the area of deactivation during some certain process. So if you remember correctly now what I showed before here, this was an artificial grammar study. Here you have no semantic information, but only syntactic or abstract information. We can also ask the brain the type, the kind of regions they are remaining silent or even drop out work during that type of process, meaning I have nothing to do with that. And interestingly enough, what pops up are so-called semantic areas, which is an additional proof of principle showing that what we are testing here has nothing to do with semantics, but probably with some different processes more lightly semantically, syntactically related. So the semantic areas of a linguistic network show deactivation during hierarchical syntactic processing. And the funny thing is that when we now compare different phrases that have identical syntactic processing, but they only change in terms of meaning, so for example, fresh apple, awake apple, which is meaningless, or fresh goofle, which has a pseudo word, we see that there is a modulation of these areas that are involved for semantic information, but not for syntactic information. So the anterior IFG, BA45-47, DATL, MTL, seem to support conceptual evaluation during word combination. Now, in this first part, to summarize in this interim summary, we can conclude that Broca's area and the posterior STG support the functional syntactic network of the adult human brain. Within this network, these two regions appear to do different things. Broca's area, specifically BA44, seems to establish syntactic structures of language sequences according to categorical information, and the hierarchical information may be sent back to the posterior STG in a recursively manner, which would act as a general integration system. And conceptual evaluation involves different areas that include angular gyrus, IFG, and DATL, which are now well known to be, for example, very damaged during, for example, semantic aphasia in elderly people. Now, we have just defined a very simple functional space, and I only show you a couple of very simple experiments to show the type of approach that we use to interface linguistic theory with neurolinguistics. But now let's try to get a little bit more fun by trying to bring the different information together to say now something which would be relevant to the timing of syntactic processing, to the where of syntactic processing, and to the when. And essentially what we do here is to bring together the knowledge that we now have about parsing models, what happens in real time when I hear a first word and then the second word and then the third word, when something happens across time, and where something could happen. And in the second part of our enterprise in our group is that of bringing together these three elements to talk about causality. So we try to infer how a specific region during a specific time frame in the online language processing may be an effect on impact on how we understand the sentence. We'll be mentioning very briefly left corner versus bottom-up models. We'll be talking about mask syntactic priming and the ELAN paradigm to look about the timing we will be interested in. And then we take these two information together with the knowledge that we know about Broca's areas to see if this area is involved at a certain point during processing. So now, very briefly, parsing models are just a way to show how we algorithmically, computationally, we go from word A to word B to word C in real time. And we can understand the sentence doing different things. According to a so-called left corner parsing model, which is a mildly top-down approach, what would happen when you hear the? Well, you know you hear the, you assume this is the terminator, you immediately open up the terminator phrase, and you predict a potential noun that would come in, or an adjective noun, and then the prediction is met, and then the element the phrase is closed. In the other case, you would have a bottom-up approach. For example, you hear the, you do nothing, the second word comes in, then you apply a rule or a feature matching between the two elements, categorical elements, and then you close up the phrase. So these two different procedures would give us different timing predictions about how we understand the sentence. So here we are asking, what happens when I hear the? Am I expecting a noun? Am I expecting a word, or I just stay silent? We are talking about milliseconds, of course. You can begin to think about that on your own. But what we do now is we started from behavior, and we begin to ask, what happens, and how quick is syntax? So in this work, there are behavioral studies, and as we tested probably all Leipzig here, there are like five studies, but I will just to show just one. This is a mask syntactic priming. It means very briefly that we show subject something like the or he for only 33 milliseconds. So they are not aware of what they have seen. There are 50-50 chance. They've seen something, but they have no idea what they've seen. And afterwards, we show a verb or a noun. And the hypothesis is that if I show you he, and afterwards I have the word apple, people take more time to say that apple is a noun, because there is an effect, predictive effect of the pronoun on the expected element, which might be a verb. Okay? So this is the hypothesis. This is rootly based on the fact that semantic priming is very existing. In semantics, if I show very briefly apple, and afterwards you see banana, you are very quickly in telling me, yes, banana is a fruit. So we move it to the syntactic domain. And Stanislav Dehaene is also working on some of these aspects. And what we did, we also, so for example, we have something like a bird or a chew, everything is completely balanced. But we also had control conditions where we did not show a pronoun or a verb or a determiner, but we show a fake determiner or a fake pronoun. So he or the, but we also showed something like or fur, they mean nothing, but it's just to see in the absence of semantic syntactic context if there would be any a similar effect on what we've seen when syntactic information is available. And what we use the response time to this to subtract away from this to see whether syntactic information generates a prediction or not. And the beautiful thing, at least according to me, is that I'll explain the graph, you don't have to understand it, that syntactic information doesn't give you any prediction. So syntactic information does not predict you anything. There is no difference between he walks and nothing walks. It takes you the same amount of time for you to say that walks is a verb, but if you have he, apple, you are strongly inhibited. The conclusion we make from this paper is the following, that syntactic priming is inhibitory and prediction seems to play a little role, at least here, at least in very small context. And to me it's very beautiful because I've always thought that syntax is not based on frequency, syntax is not based on statistics, syntactic rules are immanent in a sense, like equations in mathematics. So there is no need for you to predict something in an equation. Something is coming or not. So we only have a very weak behavioral suggestion that syntactic priming, syntax compared to semantics, which is strongly excitatory, does not include prediction. And imagine, would it be effortful for you to predict all possible nouns in the world when you hear the? Or how would be the prediction of nounness in your life? Very hard to complain. On the other thing, we also know that, and this is very old stuff, we are in the EGG world, we know that when there is, for example, the pizza is on the table, if there is an offending element after a certain category, we have a response of roughly after 200 milliseconds of a potential so-called ELAN. We know that after 200 milliseconds, we know that the brain is saying, hey, look, there's something wrong that I've heard. Okay, so we have this information. Now, the third information we move very briefly to the where is that we know that Broca's error is involved in syntactic processing. I've told you before. We know that syntax is very quick, and we know that prediction is not really there. And we know that we have left corner parsers and bottom-up parsers. So the first idea is essentially that of, I can be very quickly here, let's take the dog and let's disturb Broca's area with the so-called TMS. Let's generate a disturbance on the brain for a few milliseconds while subjects are hearing the. Let's see if Broca's area is A, doing prediction, and B, if there is any prediction at all in syntax. So subject lay, we record EG, and at the same time we zap on the brain while they're hearing the. So we long to disturb predicting processing in BA44. So we would like to show that they are not able to predict the label here. And what we see, and that's a classical now study that we have shown already before, the type of design, the hypothesis that if BA44 generates syntactic prediction, disrupting its functioning with TMS during the first word, should affect the ERP markers of frazzle building. But now the crucial point is that we find no causal evidence at all that perturbating Broca's area at the predictive stage affects the ERP correlates of basic composition. So the ELAN is still there. So we are disturbing BA44 during the processing of the, and afterwards you have a verb, the walks, so you should have an ELAN, but we disturb the processing, but the ELAN is still there. So it means that Broca's area has nothing to do with predicting processing or predicting a rule in the first part of the processing of the sentence. And here we also show there's a more complex method that we really destroyed only for a few milliseconds the brain of these people in BA44. It's not invasive at all. It's just to show that the impact of our disturbance was very present. And the funny thing is that when we compare something like these FLIRC and we remove any predicting processing, we very beautifully see involvement of BA44. So we conclude that when removing any predictive effect, we see that there is effect in Broca's area that might correspond to integration phase of two words into a phrase, which support the hypothesis that probably, at least at this stage, syntax works rather bottom-up integrating elements. So the idea is that inferior frontal regions are waiting for the second element to come in and then evaluate whether that can be combined together into a phrase. In the last part, I'll be very brief. We can conclude that syntactic composition proceeds in highly automatic fashion. Predictive processing appear to play a reduced role during syntactic processing, and the involvement of Broca's area in predictive processing seems not to be supported by the current data. So Broca's area might rather involve integrative processing than syntactic processing. And the funny part is that there is converging evidence from different papers looking at how different parsing models would correlate with hemodynamic response function in inferior frontal gyrus. In the last few minutes, I would just want to mention very briefly different type of works that we look at, first of which is modality independence. It's just to show that when looking at fMRI works on sign language, on syntactic processing, we see exactly the same regions involved, regardless of modality. So the idea is that human brain has involved a lateralized language network with the supramodal hub in Broca's area, which computes linguistic information independently of speech. So speech does not equate language. And we can now use a lot of machine learning methodologies to infer how in a 2 or 3D space, different syntactic cues might be represented in the brain to transfer a motor movement into something linguistically relevant. At the same time, at the interface between sign language and neurolinguistics and language processing in evolutionary perspective, we begin to look at how language processing per se differs from motor processing under the idea of mirror neuron hypothesis or the mutual evolution, the coevolution of language and motor processing. And what we show you in this, in a few papers now and fMRI studies coming in is that what I mentioned before, BA44 seems to be anteriorly involved in syntactic processing, but the posterior part along the premotor cortex rather involved in completely different type of words to select premotor mental representations. And to two different regions, BA44 anterior and posterior, represent two completely different functional patterns across the cortex. In the few last slides, I would like to briefly talk now about the third part of the research agenda that we have, instead of taking the two-word horizon to look at development and evolution of the combinatorial syntactic processing. Now, we know that two words combination level is an ideal testing ground, as I mentioned before, to look at the emergence of syntactic processing in children, how a child might begin to produce the book, a book, for example, to abstract over the terminals, and at the same time, how to look how non-human primates might begin to combine different vocalizations together. So, children seem to quickly switch from memorization to abstract categorical syntax during two-word production phase. We won't touch this argument too much here, but I would like to mention works from Charles Young and many people at Stanford University, for example, Michael Frank, for example. But we'll concentrate very briefly on this last part here, on the idea that non-human primates which seem to fail to process artificial grammars that loosely imitate human language, might really not go beyond the two-word, the two-call vocalization. So these are standard studies that probably most of you know, the classical speech analysis studies and many, many more different applications proposed. It seems that during perception, human primates fail to correctly process more complex AN, BN grammars, as for example those who are here. And the proposal, while here we have AB, AB associations, the proposal is that non-human primates do not go beyond the two item horizon limit. And I still remember the very beautiful paper that you also, Luigi, was mentioning about the merge zero, merge one, merge two hypothesis, where it could be a potential divide between the different species. Now in a huge enterprise with the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology, we have begin now to really look into positional transitional properties or localization of, for example, chimpanzees in the wild, and see how these skulls actually look like from the length perspective, and whether and how they might be independent of meaning. So the first thing that we look at is essentially to show that it seems that at least in production, the length, the famous mean length of utterance, but let's just call that the utterance length, goes far beyond 2 to reach 3, 4, and 5 combinations one next to each other. And it also seems that a very reduced vocal repertoire nonetheless shows some complex combinatorial network where the different elements are combined to another. But, and that's the first step, it seems that the way they combine follows some superficial organization, some such that there are some elements that always occur in first position and some elements that always occur in second position. And some of these bigrams here that I show here seem to co-occur only if preceded or followed by some specific structure. So this was just a very first study to look at how in a spontaneous production call combinations might look like in chimpanzee and how, without looking at context, these different elements can be combined to another. And it seems that chimpanzees actually have a complex combinatorial network where some elements have some special status in the position they occupy in the vocalization system. Now, the second step is to look at the relationship between these positional transitional properties and meaning, and to see whether testing the combination of calls may correspond to productive compositionality. And of course, I'm touching here a huge topic, and I'm very happy that Philippe Maella here, but it's just a last slide to mention, that I'm just showing this data here, thanks to Cedric and Cutting in Lyon and Max Planck Institute, just to show that we now begin to look at the interplay between bigrams, trigrams, and context. And the question is that what happens if I put two elements together? The meaning of this, the two elements along is retained when combined together, or there is a complete switch in context and meaning. So it's like the very famous blackmailing example. Do you have a train station, you keep the meaning of the two elements, or you are completely creating new type of context? And we use a very special form of Euclidean distance between the different contexts, and we see that there actually we see different type of compositions going on. So if you look at the composition here, the HO stays relatively clustered here. So this means that the contexts are pretty close to one another also when you take HO alone. But if you add another certain call, then there is a completely switch of meaning. And the same case is also here, where you have a PG that is completely moving the GR context here. So this is just a way to see that there are some cases where a certain call fulfills a certain similar function regardless of the element with which it is combined. But in some other case, another call somehow switches completely the meaning or the context of occurrence of the call. And with this slide, I would like just to propose a testing empirical hypothesis that we are putting forward now since a few years, is that probably the working hypothesis over which I do not take stance, but just rather suggestions, is that maybe that Broca's area and the posterior STG form the functional syntactic network of the adult human brain. Syntactic processing, I'm trying to show you, that is an highly automatic, multimodal, domain-specific process, which work over abstract categories. We have seen this through, via artificial grammar. We have seen the automaticity through, for example, masking and the EEG studies. It's multimodal, which is regardless of whether it's speech or signed, or it's domain-specific in the sense there might be a huge divide between humans and non-human species. The arcuate fasciculus linking Broca's areas with PSTG might be the structural requirement enabling humans to combine words into abstract syntactic categories. And with this, by assigning different functions to different regions that I discussed before, conceptual combination, associations, and potential hierarchical processing along the structure, I would like to thank you for the attention. Thanks for all people joining this very important works during conference during and after the pandemic in online in Japan. And I would like to thank all the colleagues and in Leipzig, in Heidelberg, in Göttingen, in Lyon, and in China, among many, and all the other lists here. My boss, Federici, and I would like to wish a happy Republic Day to all the Italian people here in the audience. And with this, I'm happy to get questions from you. Thank you very much.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.